Amory Lovins is our guest. We are his guest at Rocky Mountain Institute. I am Paula Gordon. This is Bill Russell.
You tell a lot of good stories. You do a lot of good work. And I don't know about most of it. And I have the sense that, part of the challenge, I mean, what you're describing is a world that is moving rapidly, the business world that is moving rapidly in, some very positive directions in terms of the application of resources, in terms of, all a variety of resources, human resources, energy resources, all the things that go into to a business environment, and yet we don't know much about it. And that seems to be part of the challenge, because people tend to not want to get too far ahead. And if they don't know about these things, it's much easier to continue to do incremental, static, bad engineering. So am I wrong? Is it just that we don't know about it? Or are you just incredibly optimistic?
Well, a lot of what we do is cultural change, being kind of cultural repairmen and women working kind of in the belly of the beast, because if you just work with a company on product, process, and market, and you don't deal with culture, structure, and business model, you probably will come unstuck. Mm-hmm. But the most exciting companies are the ones that want to reinvent themselves quite thoroughly, and those are the ones that gain the biggest leapfrog kind of advantage. They're the ones that prove what Ed Willard said when he chaired DuPont, that companies that take such opportunities seriously will do very well, while he added, those that don't won't be a problem, because ultimately they won't be around. I think that's what's going to sort out the leaders and laggards. It's already happening in the stock market. You see, you've seen for the past 5 or 10 years very distinct branching of industries like chemicals, where those that are green and innovative have much performance in all respects than the ones that still have dirty processes and are making things that nobody wants. You know, why should you spend money making wastes and emissions? That stuff nobody wants. Let's design it out. We call it unsaleable production to help focus people's attention on why are we making something no one wants. And I have yet to find a business audience that doesn't get excited about this stuff. But, you know, different people in different parts of the company get excited at different levels, do different things about it. And you get leadership emerging at all levels. That's where you find the difference between leadership and management.
It would seem that one of the challenges in this, you make a strong economic argument, and yet in terms of the metrics, the things that we look at are those things that can be monetized, which are not what we would characterize as natural capital or as human capital. And trying to make sense of it, one way of making sense of it is to say that the model you're talking about just drags along the natural capital, the human capital, or that somehow or other it is getting monetized.
Well, maybe you're conditioned by the normal economic belief that what we really need to do is figure out what nature and culture and community are worth, and if we put them all on the balance sheet, all will be well.
Well, and that's precisely what I'm trying to get past.
I don't take
that
view. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, instead, that's called environmental economics. The ecological economics view is that nature is the envelope that contains, sustains, and provisions the economy. The economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment, not the other way around. And natural capitalism is then a way of doing business as if nature and people were properly valued, but without needing to figure out what they're worth or how to signal it on the balance sheet. It turns out that even today, when nature and people are valued at roughly zero, you make a lot more money being a natural capitalist. So that's the key. We don't need to wait decades, you know, through all the academic arguments to figure out what nature's worth. We can just behave as if it were very valuable, and that's a much better way to do business.
But what you're saying is, even in the absence of that, if you behave appropriately, if you make these creative, imaginative design decisions, these holistic, systemic decisions, that alone will give you a leg up. But if in addition you are also at least consciously in some way valuing, not monetizing, but valuing these other forms of capital.
Oh, that would help, but it's not essential to get to a good outcome. And, you know, just as a simple example, think about the climate change controversy, where I think just about everybody that's honest and paying attention realizes that the science is saying there's a big problem here. But I would suggest it doesn't matter how the climate science turns out. We ought to do the same things about this issue anyway just to make money, because it's cheaper to save fuel than to buy fuel. Efficiency is cheaper than fuel. So even if there were no climate problem, we should still be using fuel several fold more efficiently, and smart companies are doing that.
Which allows you to step out of the arguments?
Absolutely.
And focus on what's the problem?
Well, and focus
or
on what are the 60 or 80 well-known obstacles that prevent people from buying energy efficiency and have to turn each one into a business opportunity. So we wrote that up actually in Facing Columns, and it's your prospector's guide. It's at rmi.org, and it's called Climate Making Sense and Making Money. Now, just a couple of examples. DuPont has said that worldwide in this decade it'll be raising its energy efficiency at least 6% a year. It'll be getting a tenth of its energy and a quarter of its raw materials by 2010 from renewable sources. And by then it should have decreased its CO2 emissions to 65% below the 1990 level. Or ST Microelectronics, the world's fourth biggest chip maker, figures by 2010 it'll be making 40 times as many chips it'll be making in 1990, but it has a goal of emitting zero net carbon by then. Well, we helped them figure out how to save about 92% of their carbon per chip profitably now, 98 or 99% profitably in a few years. And it makes their chip-making plants build cheaper and faster and work better. That's the real key to competitive advantage. So these things are being done in the name of shareholder value. You know, when BP recently announced it had met its carbon reduction goals 7 years early, they said at zero net cost. Well, Lord Brown was a bit bashful. He should have said, actually, we made $650 million on the deal, because they did.
It is interesting, as you go through these litanies of companies, you're not talking about somebody in the garage tinkering. You're talking about some of the world's biggest corporations.
Mm-hmm. And there's a reason that they're big. They have smart people. And it's actually harder to manage a big company. You have to be even smarter. So I think these examples are some of, actually, they're the tip of a rather large iceberg that's very, very encouraging. And any company, again, that's paying attention knows that it will increase shareholder value by wringing out its energy and materials waste, closing its loops, designing out its toxicity, aligning its interests with those of its customers. The successful companies will be those that take their design from nature, their values from their customers, and their discipline from the marketplace.
In some circles, Joseph Schumpeter has been much quoted, specifically the Gales of Creative Destruction, talking about the fact that there are companies, that economies, as they progress, inevitably, some companies will fall by the wayside as new companies are formed, which is great if you happen to be one of those new companies. I would assume, though, that there is those people who are in the midst of that gale and are not responsive will tend to use other mechanisms, lobbying, a whole range of different things, to avoid doing or making it possible to do some of the things that perhaps you're suggesting.
Well, we've given a lot of thought to that because we've tackled the largest economic sectors as both obstacles and opportunities, often as partners in that transformation. For example, electricity, which is about the most capital-intensive sector. I have a book coming out from Rocky Mountain Institute at the end of August called Small is Profitable, The Hidden Economic Benefits of Making Electrical Resources the Right Size. And it shows 207 distributed benefits that typically make decentralized generators about tenfold more valuable than had been thought. Well, the companies that own the centralized system can try to fight that and they'll go down, or they can treat it as a wonderful business opportunity and they'll get better service at lower cost, higher profit with less risk. The place that we find this most interesting and challenging is transforming the auto industry. I think we're making good progress with the oil industry, showing how they'll be better off, say, in a hydrogen and efficiency and renewables economy. And companies like Shell and BP have been taking that road. But the car industry is more of a challenge. It's a $1 trillion industry. And I've been reinventing it the last dozen years.
So I don't have to interrupt you in the middle of that. Let's come back and talk about automobility. I hadn't thought of it as automobility until reading Natural Capitalism, of which Amory Lovins is one of the three authors. Bill Russell and I are pleased to be in Snowmass, Colorado with Mr. Lovins. We'll all be back in a moment. Stay with us.